This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and Stuart Moss is here with a new book. Here is Stuart with a new poem.
This book of poems is called For Those Whose Lives Have Seen Themselves. And many of the poems in this book are an exploration of what it means to see, not just look, but to see. So let me read the first poem, which is called A Kind of Attentiveness. I wrote this poem many years ago, and it's kind of been sitting in a file until I started putting this, this collection together. Kind of Attentiveness. What is seeing and knowing what I see? Is it what philosophers call coming into the nearness of distance? That groping outward breath by breath as the quickening world reaches forward and grabs the quivering brain? What is it to see a field of snow burst into its own brilliance, then retreat into stillness? Or a splayed birch pierce the lead sky as it melts overhead? Ah, to be only a breathing form with eyes and crouch here forever gazing until my bones are bare, arranged within the body of the scene.
That is the voice of Stuart Moss. Stuart, tell us what is in this book. What is the title of the book again, and what you think the book contains. What is the theme? Besides seeing, what do you think you're saying in this book?
Well, as I said, it's for those whose lives have seen themselves. And a little bit later, I'll read the title poem. It's, as the title implies, it is an exploration of the phenomenon of seeing, as I said earlier, but it's also a time of my poetry, because I've traveled a lot, and I'll read a couple of poems later that are set in places where I was fortunate to be before the outbreak of civil war and unrest. So in that respect, I consider my poems to be a kind of reportage. In the collection, there are about 8 poems that are set in various locations around the world. And I look back, I didn't write the poems at the time I was there, because I didn't really think of myself as a poet back then. Because most of these experiences took place in the 1970s when I was working, and I was kind of an itinerant teacher traveling around and teaching for a while and then traveling, and then I would run out of money, I would find another teaching job, and I would travel and so forth.
Stuart, I have the feeling when I read your poetry that it comes from a very deep silence. That's the only way I can describe it, that it comes from a place that is so quiet. And I don't get that feeling very often. Can you help me to understand why I feel that?
You know, socially, I'm not a very quiet person. I'm very gregarious and love talking with people and meeting new people. But I think my poetry comes from a place of deep reflection, contemplation. Several of the poems that I've written, especially recently, have come to me sometimes when I'm, you know, sitting out on my porch on a beautiful day, and something triggers some thought that will become a poem.
And well, give us an example. Let's hear for ourselves this poem that comes from silence. Okay. Stuart Moss. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
This is a poem in the book called A Kind of Floating. His days are a limbo between two darknesses. Gray before the sun lifts slowly from its curved bed, then disappears hours later behind a shadowy hedge. He feels the empty spaces his heartbeats occupy like thoughts that are as illusory as vapor. A kind of floating without the thick heaviness of the ocean under him, or even the rushing currents of the river he must cross, swirling amidst the glistening solid rocks. His heart thuds its way forward, and somewhere in the distance, he knows it will stop. Perhaps in the next darkness, with its stars shedding ancient tears that water the meadows of asphodel, where he will lay down among them open his eyes to the clouds and know that he is their brother.
Don't we wish? How beautiful. Somewhere in the distance it will stop. But that has an uplifting feeling for some reason. So contemplation is a kind of bliss, would you say, that is in your poetry? There is a bliss in your poetry. Are you aware of it?
I wouldn't call it bliss, but I understand what you mean. I think it's really a kind of quiet observation.
And acceptance.
Yeah, where I'm observing what's happening in the physical world around me and also how that resonates with what's happening within me.
Would you go as far as to say it's almost a Buddhist kind of noticing and seeing and being present? It's so deep.
Yes. Yeah, I think that is true. And I have been influenced by, I'm not a Buddhist per se, but I have been influenced by Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist thought. And I think that definitely is part of it. I don't have a meditation practice as many other, you know, Buddhists do, but I think I've always been kind of a meditator.
without having
a formal practice.
This is clearly meditation poetry, clearly, and let us experience more of it.
All right, well, let me read a poem that is not in the book, but I think it comes out of that same quiet place that you were talking about. This is a poem that I wrote fairly recently, really at the end of autumn, or shortly before at the beginning of this past winter. It's called COVID Autumn. Even mixing green beans with a mustard vinaigrette for Sabbath dinner, I still recall just days ago how the gulls glided weightless over the creek, and the muted colors of late autumn called attention to everything but themselves. Yet how the joy I felt was subdued by my intellectual gaze, and I questioned how such beauty could exist. But then it came to me as swift as wings and the breeze, never to interrogate joy or begrudge anything so free that it carves its life out of the sky, even as the winter chill and heavy shadows intrude.
There's the key word for you, weightless. There's the key word for you, weightless. That's your poetry. You know, I am finding that the young people don't know the canon of poetry. They don't even know the 20th century poets. So what is the value of knowing our antecedents without being starchy? I'm not trying to be stuffy about this, but what do you believe we need to know about those who have written before us, Stuart?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, for one thing, you appreciate the beauty of language. And you come to appreciate the beauty of music and the way that language and music are combined by some of the great poets. I taught for many years in the classroom, and I tried to teach very differently from the way I was taught myself, which was very much, taking apart the poem and analyzing it and so on and so forth. And I think that destroys the spontaneity of poetry as a form, as a literary form, and as a musical form as well. So when I used to teach poetry, I would simply recite the poem, read the poem, or if I could find a recording of the poet, of which there are many available, reading the poem, him or herself, I would do that as well. And then I would start the conversation from there. How did this poem affect you? What did it, you know, what do you take from it? And then I would say, all right, let's, you know, take those reactions that you have. Let's go back and see what may have, within the poem, what may have actually spurred those reactions that you had.
Good stuff.
Very, very different from, you know, the what I was taught back in the 1960s.
Well, apparently it did not hurt you a bit the way you were taught.
Thank you.
whatever they did worked. So let's hear some more of what you believe by what you say. Stuart Moss. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on remote.
Let me read a poem. It's not in the book, but it's actually one of my favorite poems. And I think it's a poem that could have been written as easily about the Chesapeake Bay as it was about Tamales Bay, which is in northern Marin County in California. I happened to be there with some on work and had a few hours, and I'm a great lover of oysters. And so I had read about this place in Marshall, which is right on Tamales Bay, that had fantastic oysters. So this poem is a kind of response to a very wonderful experience that I had there. It's called Beatitude of Oysters Above Tamales Bay. Blessed are we who eat oysters, slippery with brine, and slide them into our mouths with greed and gratitude above the lapis flats of Tamales Bay. Blessed is the tongue, for it seeks out flavor in all things, and not just oysters, but the frothy tang of Lagunitas IPA and the sweet flesh residing in the beloved's hidden shallows. Blessed, too, is Al the Shucker, who pries open each shell with such care, he might be birthing a lamb, or like a potter, shaping the quivering muscle with his own hands. Blessed is the white-hulled boat whose wake bisects the water and splits in two the heart's grasping. And blessed is the ocean and the tidal tumult from which all life springs. Blessed is the oyster itself, which through long forbearance of murk and mud pumps them into purity, as if it sees how much the water means to us who scud and drift upon it. For we shall know the sea as a mother and return to it as if in our own first floating. The light bulges and blossoms, galleons of clouds pause into the voyages, and Al raises his knife for a moment, wipes it on the slickness of his apron, then continues with his delicate laboring.
Oh, I think that is my favorite poem as well. There is, it's sacred and sensual. What a combination. You can't do better than that. Sacred and sensual at the same time. No, I see oysters in a very different way. Very different way. I'd like you to take another of your poems and tell us, first read it, and then tell us, if you can remember, what triggered this particular poem? Where were you when you got the first sensation or the first image of it? How you progressed, how you entered the poem, how you brought it home? I'd like you to see it as a process on the page and tell us, give us a, we're in the backstage of the theater now, and we want to see how it's put together. So if you will read it first, and then we'll hear you explicate.
Okay. Well, let me read the, I think a poem that will answer those questions that you have is the title poem of the book, actually. It's called For Those Whose Lives Had Seen Themselves. And it begins with an epigraph, which I'll explain later, but let me read the epigraph. I am returning without you from the place we went together. This is spoken by a young woman in Istanbul, Turkey. Welcome all who have traveled the long road from where your deepest dreams began in the wild ferment of sleep, or when profoundly drunk or stoned, and walked out with whatever heavy burdens you carry, your thumb outstretched, and maybe your other hand taunting death with a sign saying Beirut or Aleppo or Istanbul. Looked at the reflection of yourself in your lover's Ray-Bans and asked what it meant to see the world and break the bonds that held you to a former life. If only you could name the thick liquid in which you floated, assured by the certainty of the next day and all the days to come. I remember in a cheap hotel in Amsterdam, where the pipes entered and returned through wide, rough holes in the sheetrock, watching a couple make love in the next room, ashamed that I denied them their privacy, their fumbling intimacy. Perhaps they watched us too, as we abandon ourselves for a few moments above the bustling canals and in the cracked mirror bolted to the wall opposite our bed. Who knows what became of them, or any of us who are left in crummy hotel rooms by those we desire, or because of bullets shattering raucous dancers in a nightclub. Sometimes clarity only comes with loss, for it tightens the skin that binds us to our own silhouettes and makes our shadows sharper, more distinct in the sun, or disappear forever in the darkening, unholy cities.
Take it apart.
Well, I wrote this poem in response to a terrible tragedy that happened in New Year's Eve of 2017 in this Club Reina, Istanbul, where there was a New Year's Eve party going on and a gunman slaughtered 33 of the people who participated in that, were participating in that event. And the epigraph is spoken by 7R7, who survived the shooting. She was interviewed afterwards, and her husband, not her husband, but her partner had not survived. That's why she says, "I am returning without you from the place we went together." I was really shaken by this event. Although I had never been to the Club Reina, I had been in Istanbul many times. And I wanted to write a poem not only to explore this terrible event, but to kind of make it part of my own, sort of looking back at my own travels, my own life, my own explorations, and kind of putting it all together into a context that had the theme of seeing, but was also a kind of a eulogy.
Mm-hmm.
This terrible event, and for just the general feeling, you know, back in 2017 or 2018, of the darkening of the cities. You know, the fact that, you know, Istanbul, of course, was Constantinople at one time. It was a holy city, still is for many Muslims. It has the beautiful mosque there. And how it was impossible to think of any city anymore that one could call a holy city. And that's why the poem ends, "Unholy City." So it's an exploration of my own life, my own thoughts, and also, as I've said, a kind of eulogy for not just the deaths of these 33 victims, but also all people who have been abandoned in different ways.
Yes. The fact that you say clarity only comes with loss is very interesting to me, because the poem is the product of loss, and the poem makes clear loss, so that you're really prophesying what you're writing without knowing that it is a prophecy. So I think that is a very important poem. And I like the insertion, the humanness of the voyeurism in the center of the poem, because the insertion of that other kind of red stripe and a blue painting, you know, is what we can't teach, but we wish people would learn.
Well, it's an incident that I'm not proud of, but I remember, I remember it very vividly, even though it took place, this act of voyeurism took place many, many years ago.
But there's a humanity about that in a world where our human beings are being, you know, eradicated. So I think it's a very significant piece of that poem. And I think people could learn a lot by inserting something into the center of a poem so it can fan out from that into a bigger meaning. So let us keep going. I do find your words weightless, floating. I do think that your choice of words is very interesting, as the writer, maybe you're not objective enough to see them as I am, but the tone of your work comes from a great effortlessness. And I don't know how we get that except maybe by being effortless.
Thank you very much. That's a great compliment. And I just think it comes from a life of loving words and loving music and, you know, paying attention to the world, to other people.
All that is broken is from lack of language, someone said to me. Yes, we would like another poem, Stuart Moss. And the new book is for those whose lives have seen themselves. Listen to the lyricism. For those whose lives have seen themselves. The E's, the vowels, the double vowels. That's what we call tone. Let's go.
Okay, here's another one of those, since you've made this point. Here's another poem that came to me very spontaneously when I was sitting out in my porch, possibly with an adult beverage by my side. This is called Reading Buber, Martin Buber, who formulated the very important I and Thou, wrote a book called I and Thou, in which he explores how the relationship we have with whatever divine being we have a relationship with should be interactive, and it should be the same relationship we have with each other. And I was reading Buber sitting out on my porch, and this quotation came to me drew my attention. It's called, "All actual life is encounter. All actual life is encounter." So this is called Reading Buber. Everything in the living world is connected to everything else. Just the appearances of things are different. The vast silver maple that spreads its branches over the yard so a cardinal has a perch to sing from is connected to the bird in the deeper realm of their ancient molecules that existed long before any of us learned what our own voices sounded like. So the tree and the bird are joined to me and also to the woman I love who sits in her study writing a story about another tree and the artist who tried to paint it long after it first drew life from the earth. Beneath my skin, I am with her, and all I see, says Martin Buber, as I read him out here on the porch, embraced by his ecstatic words and all that surrounds me.
I love it. You go from the very large concept to the woman in the room nearby. You telescope in and in and in, writing a story about a tree. And it is one of my very favorites.
Thank you.
That's a real important porch. You're really sitting on a serious kind of porch there. I wouldn't give that one up.
It's a wonderful space. It's a wonderful space.
Don't give that one up. Or we'll never have another poem, maybe. Well, let's continue on and set us up. Set us up for another one. Stuart Moss.
All right. This will be an easy one to explain. I think it's almost, this is the second poem in the book. It's called The School Art Studio. And I wrote this poem many years ago. And because it's also a poem about seeing, I wanted to include it in this book. The School Art Studio. In the center is a chair of chipped blue enamel, shedding its paint among dismembered frames, old school desks scored with blood and lust, a wobbly terracotta jug filled with the dead grasses of autumn, and a red umbrella unfastened, dangling its nylon fronds on the scarred oak floor. The model's clothes are flung on the chair, her rumpled sweater, the tallow color of dried mulberries, her dungarees drawn in upon themselves, the belt uncinched, its buckle grooves creeping inward, hole by hole, upon an old black coat, shiny with wear. The evasive sun comes slatted through the window, and I feel a tenderness for nakedness, for all the people who come and go, stepping lightly through the artifacts, and leave their clothes as signals, like semaphores in the night.
Interesting. You, there's another telescoping in. You start with an object, which is really impossible to turn away from as your entry into the poem. And then you move into the humanity. Always the humanity is the center of your work. It is always our humanness that you're capturing, whether it's through a tree or a debacle or an art studio. Do you agree? Am I right about that?
Yeah, I think, as I say, my poetry, I think unconsciously or semi-consciously reflects, my looking outward and looking inward, looking outward, and then trying to put the pieces together in a, mm-hmm. in a continuous flow that makes sense.
It occurs to me that it would be good if people would think before they wrote. What do you think of that? There's a thinkingness in your poems because, I look for so many things. In poetry, I look for the sensuality and the intuition and everything. And the thinking, people don't understand that you don't have to give an idea outright, but to think, to just sit on your porch and think, then the image will match that. Maybe not with everyone. Maybe you have a special gift that not everyone has, but they could learn. They could learn from it.
Well, yeah, and I think the thinking is not a necessarily conscious decision, Thoughts come, I can't really turn them off. They come, and if they grab me, I pause and sort of pay attention to them and explore them a little.
But they must come in silence. Silence
yes.
is where God lives, or silence is where your mind can come to the surface.
Yeah.
And that is what I hear and what I see in your work more than most. So let's hear one more poem and see if I'm right.
Okay, this poem is called What Is Left. What is left? The tabula rasa of the day reveals its openness, a landscape in which nothing has been painted. No white farmhouse at the end of a long drive through planted fields, no copse of oaks offering shade or pond, where flashes of silver streak to the surface and raptors swoop down to seize the shadows. No piebald cows deep in their grazing. The shimmering air smudges what the heart wants, and high above the clouds congregate and plot their journey across the sky. At what corner of the canvas will they begin their sketch of heaven? Desire's slow progress is what points the way ahead, and nothing not arising from our wanting finds traction. I remember my first taste of wine and the longing to feel what lay inside the grape's dark ferment. So when the girl whose pale eyes were like sea glass wiped the liquid from her lips, held the bottle out to me and said, "Now you," I wasn't surprised by its sour sorrow, as if the vine's roots had reached down into a cavern and drawn their nourishment from silence and emptiness. Still, I wanted more, a craving born from the sweetness I knew the fruit should give, when all the tractors have ceased and from what is left after many, many crushings.
I think it's we should note the question in the middle of the poem, who at what corner of the canvas, because that is very significant. The smallest part of your poem is the biggest part of your poem. And to ask a question is really gives us a real burst of energy there in that poem. Stuart Moss, we are your fans, and I'd love to hear a closing poem.
All right. Well, I haven't, apart from that, title poem. I haven't really read any poems that take place in other places where I've been. So let me read one of my favorite poems. It's a short poem, and this is when my daughter and I fell in love with my daughter. She was very little, you know, and I, apart from the paternal love that one feels automatically for a child, I hadn't really connected with her. And this is a poem written trying to, I'll read the poem and I think you can ask me a question about it. I don't want to say too much about it first. It's called When I Fell in Love with Sarah, My Daughter. We sat in the park, she just awake, her eyes cast upward, up toward the dry August trembling of oak leaves, a slant of pigeons drifting downward with their claws spread, and a few looping pearls of cloud. Sarah, I said, her name still new to me, my teeth and lips not used to it, and read to her from a fat book of poems I fished from the stroller's blue pouch. She looked at me so gravely, I thought, her tiny lashes feathering the air and softening the tumble of syllables upon her. Those words were gifts, the husks of seeds already falling, and her eyes, they gave back leaves, wings, the lighting sky, the warm brown earth, the stilling wonder of naming.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, Rivada Foundation, Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.